Welcome to City Talks, a new podcast series looking at the big ideas, issues and developments affecting cities across the UK. I'm Andrew Carter from the Centre for Cities, and each month I'll be discussing a different topic with a panel of city experts. I hope you enjoy the programme. Welcome to this episode of City Talks, where we're going to be looking at how cities and local authorities have been coping with the pressures of deficit reduction and how they can help balance the nation's books. The deficit is one of the central issues of the election campaign. Regardless of which party or combination of parties forms the next government, reducing it will be at the top of their list of priorities. Balancing the books is partly about improving growth and getting more revenue into government coffers, but it's also likely to involve further spending cuts and efficiency savings in the next few years, at a level which can fundamentally alter the way that the state operates. But there are opportunities created by this transformation as well. If the central state is to become smaller in the future, cities and local authorities will have to fill the gap. Arguably, they might be better able to coordinate the different parts of the public sector in their local area and provide public services more efficiently than a distant central state. But there are also concerns. Local government has been at the forefront of austerity measures over the last 5 years. Total departmental spend has fallen by nearly 10% over the last parliament, while funding for local authorities has fallen by 37%. Councils have coped remarkably well and have significantly higher approval ratings than Whitehall and Westminster, but some question whether cities have the capacity to take on these new responsibilities that currently reside with the centre. And there are risks involved with allowing cities to keep more of the taxes they collect or vary, and indeed to create new taxes. Will the principle of redistribution from rich to poor areas be lost with greater autonomy? How do we avoid the dreaded postcode lottery? Joining me to discuss these issues, I have Simon Parker, Chief Executive of the New Local Government Network, and Professor Tony Travers from the London School of Economics. Tony, turning to you first, can you just give us a sense as to how cities and local authorities get their money, how they spend it, and how that's changed over the last 10 years? Because we want to get a sense as to the impact that the austerity and the reduction in public finances had on local government.
Councils receive their income in part from council tax, everybody knows that. They also get a large chunk of income from government grants. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. And of course, they also get some income from fees and charges, the charges they make for services, which can be things as wide-ranging as council housing on one part of their lives, all the way across to car parking charges, or in London, tube fares. So there's a wide range of income sources. Now, council tax is fixed, in effect. It's capped. Government controls it. If we'll put council tax up by more than 2% a year, then in the end the council would have to hold a referendum. And councils know they don't risk one of those, so they don't do that. So that's capped council tax. Grants have been falling very substantially. And indeed, a government has cut grant very significantly since the present government took office in 2010. Now, in the middle of all of that, there was a slight reform to the grant system, so that in effect councils kept half of their business rates. Businesses will know they pay business rates, but that part of the business rates they keep, they don't set the rate on it, they just keep the yield from it, so they can grow the tax base and have an incentive to do that. So they get a bit of income from the business rate, though that led them to get less grants, so they weren't better off or worse off as a result of that reform. If you stand back from all of this system and say cities, local authorities more generally, where do they, how much control over this income do they have? The answer is not much, because the government is capping the council tax. The grant has been cut by central government, and there is some freedom still over fees and charges. It's only limited, and the government's been trying to discourage them from putting those up as well. So in the end, councils find that their income is falling simply because government is cutting their grant and freezing their tax.
And Simon, reflections on Tony's points there, but also local government, local authorities have been on the receiving end. There were quite significant cuts when you compare it to other parts of the state. Why is that?
Well, I think Tony just did a very good job of explaining a horrendously complicated system. And the other thing I think you realise when you step back is that the current finance system is just a mess. You know, you take council tax, for instance. When you pay your council tax bill, it's based on the value of your house in 1992. That's crazy. I mean, it's socially unjust because it means that if you're one of the winners from the housing market, you're effectively getting a subsidy from people living in cheaper housing or from rented housing. It's a crazy tax, and it's not even really a local tax anymore. So we've ended up with a system which is messy. It's based on some very confused principles. Parts of the system work on need. Parts of them are moving towards being based on growth. It's one of those things where we've made additions, we've made tweaks over 20-odd years, and the result is a complete mishmash, which anyone sane would step back from and reform. The problem is no one really wants to reform it because the costs of change are very high and the benefits for national politicians are actually very low. I guess there will come a point over the next 5 years when that may start to change, partly because council cuts, and we've seen already something like a 40% cut in central government grants, those cuts are going to start making it quite hard to sustain services in some places. So one council we work with, Darlington, very small unitary council, huge pressures. This is a council that's wondering how it will afford to clean the streets by 2017, and it's very seriously thinking about that. And the answer is probably they will have to change social norms so that people don't drop litter anymore. Which, you know, is not impossible, but is pretty radical considering that cleaning up the rubbish is one of the things we set councils up to do. Why has local government been so vulnerable in all of this? I think it's partly because it's a soft political target. People don't really know what councils do. They don't understand the full range of services. They assume that they're run by a very large group of grey-suited men and women who are paid a lot of money. And a lot of the time, they rather resent that. So I think they're an easy target for the government to kick. I think local government often doesn't do a very good job of making its case. It's very fragmented. It's party political. Compare local government with its 350 different leaderships to the NHS, with its one leadership and a direct phone line to the Department of Health. Let's look at the difference between what's happened in those two sectors. Local government's cut huge amounts of its budget. It's become very productive. It's been quite innovative in lots of places. And so the line nationally is, well done, local government. This means you can take another 40%. Health, on the other hand, has underperformed in many cases. Its productivity has been appalling. And yet, we say, oh, well done, health, for your appalling performance. Let's give you some more money to sort it out. And it does come down to the politics. Health, we all know what it is. We all know what it does. It's where we take our kids on a Sunday morning if they're ill to A&E. We don't do that with local government.
Tony, just give us a sense as to, we've had the 5 years, and Simon was mentioning 40% or thereabouts cuts in government grant. Where does that bring us back to? In the sense, if we think about the decade prior to the recession, local government getting more money, along with the other bits of the state as well, and then obviously a quite severe reduction over the last 5 years. Where does that bring us back to? Because one of the issues that Simon's already touched on is a concern that these cuts will either can be absorbed by local government or actually will completely change the way that local government has to operate in the future. So just where are we?
Well, if only that question was easy to answer, as it were, to ask. But let's have a go here. Now, the thing is, the reduction in local government spending doesn't apply even to all of local government spending. This is why it's been possible for ministers to argue local government spending hasn't been falling very much, because they use a definition of spending which includes all sorts of things like housing benefit and where they've added new services to local government, all added in. If we stand back and say, of all the things local government is doing today, where it sets the budget itself, which it was also doing 10, 15, 20 years ago, then the cuts on that are pretty substantial. I mean, certainly in day-to-day spending for councils is now down like 20-25%, or certainly will be by the end of this year for many of them. And that would take us back, not to the beginning of times, not to the 1930s, but probably back to the late 90s, the early 2000s, that kind of time. And certainly if you look at the number of people employed by local government, it takes you back to around then, and that's probably a good guide to it. But, of course, In the meantime, in that quite long period since then, all our expectations grow. We hear a great deal about growth in the elderly population, the growth in demands, growth in population. But of course, all of that has to be absorbed by local government within this declining amount of spending. So not only is the population increasing, becoming more elderly, and so on, but actually our expectations increase. You know, if you went to a supermarket today and saw what was in the supermarket on offer in 1999, you wouldn't think it was a great, great offer. And that's the problem.
So somewhat ironically, we have a national conversation or context at the minute, which is all about devolving responsibility and powers and such down to local levels. But then are we worried that the austerity and the changes in funding have essentially stripped out a lot of the capacity for local authorities to take on some of what's been offered to them or potentially offered to them by central government?
It's a really good question, and it varies hugely because we're talking about very different sorts of organisation. So there are a lot of councils which are going to struggle to find the thinking capacity to take on big new responsibilities around economic growth and development, and that's what we're really talking about here. That's the power that's coming down. On the other hand, if you look at places like Greater Manchester, West Yorkshire, what you're seeing, I think, very intelligently is councils starting to come together and saying, look, individually, as metropolitan districts, we can't possibly create the capacity we need to manage growth across the city region. But if we work together and create pooled forms of that capacity, we can bring in economists, we can bring in people who know about stats, we can start to build much stronger economic strategies.
And I suppose one of the issues there is that, you know, part of this agenda has been very keen to talk about devolving responsibilities and powers, less keen to talk about devolving significant chunks of money and particularly fiscal-related responsibilities. Why is that, Tony?
Well, the reason is, I guess, that we live in a very, very centralised country where the national political class, I have to call it that, doesn't believe anybody can control public spending and taxation in particular better than it can. So despite all the evidence of the contrary over many years, people in the Treasury honestly believe, I think they do honestly believe, that if they didn't control public spending, somehow it would all get out of control. Now, it's hard to know where to begin, given the state of the public finances in recent years, but still. The truth is that we've ended up with a very centralised public finance system where 95% of all the taxes set in the UK are set by national government, and the only 5% that aren't are council tax, and the government has capped them. So effectively it's 100%. So, and we just don't know as a society, as a governmental system, as a set of political institutions at the top level, how to move away from that. All other countries don't do it like this. You know, sort of Germany or Sweden or America, choose your example. They're all in a world in which many more of these decisions are made outside the centre. But we've convinced ourselves, and, you know, in fairness to governments, it's reinforced a bit by the postcode lottery issue, that somehow if the all-seeing national government sets all the taxes and the all-seeing government allocates all the money to everywhere, that somehow that will be good and fair.
Is it credible, Simon, that part of the argument for local authorities is to say to central government, you know, we can reduce the deficit more efficiently, more effectively, more imaginatively than you can if you simply give us part of the... Are you seeing part of that argument being made by different authorities and groups of local authorities?
I think we're certainly seeing that argument being made, and I think we're doing it on quite good evidence, because if you look at what's happened over the last 5 years... Look at the aggregates. So, you know, look at public sector employment. In central government, public sector employment has been rising. The overall reductions are coming from local government. So this is, in a sense, you know, that local government is very much at the front line of taking these cuts. Back in 2010, people like Albert Bohr were saying the sky was going to fall in. And it hasn't, because actually we've seen people changing the way they do social care. We've seen people changing the way they do place services. So I keep hearing people saying there's this global race on to reinvent government for the 21st century, and I really think it's English cities that are in the forefront of that. Now, you know, we've had 5 years where I think councils have had to take, very big cuts. In a sense, what they've done is they've slimmed down. So, you know, you go back to 2010, you had quite large local authorities. They were doing stuff that was valuable, but perhaps not essential. You know, I was in a London borough recently that had had to cut its Cypriot men's lunch club. Now, that's a shame for those people, but there's probably another way for them to get their lunch. We're reaching a point now where local authorities have slimmed down, where they're pretty lean, but we're not going to stop now. We're going to keep on cutting. And I think that's going to have to lead to some very radical forms of transformation in the way we do services. And we're seeing that coming to the fore. I mean, look at the debate about the NHS in the general election. That's dominated by health and social care integration. I think employability, getting people back into work, cutting benefits, is going to be the next frontier for that. So I think there is a very strong argument for saying that if you devolve money, not just local authority money, but if you devolve the money delivering public services in a place to that place, you can probably find much better ways to spend it than if you stick with the current set of central government silos and targets.
How much traction do you think that kind of argument that Simon's just laid out is getting, or has already been got by the Chancellor and by the Treasury, I guess, more so than the spending departments, Tony?
I mean, the Treasury, you know, having been slightly sharp about them earlier on, probably do get this, actually. I mean, the Treasury do see the need to try to manage not only the total public expenditure, but to use what is still a very, very large sum of public money better. And I think, you know, that having watched local government, as Simon says, manage the last few years so effectively, they must wonder a lot in the Treasury, you know, how much more might they deliver such efficiencies if they ran more of these services. Because from the Treasury's point of view, the great thing about local government is that they don't actually see it very often. It's a long way away, whereas their colleagues from other spending departments are all too nearby making their case for more money. So I think that the Treasury probably is an ally for local government in all of this. But that begs the question of how powerful the Treasury is in being able to deliver on this kind of agenda. Now, in that sense, George Osborne's championing of Greater Manchester and other northern cities is interesting because it suggests he's sort of taken over, really, in a rather Gordon Brown-like way, to impose his will on these kind of issues. And if he's going to do it with the health service for Greater Manchester, which is a radical change, then, well, you can go a lot further down that route, providing the Chancellor of the Exchequer wants to.
And Simon, do we have more than, you know, the Greater Manchester example, which unfortunately in many instances we have to, you know, we go back to and say this is what's happening in Manchester, but, you know, your work with local government across the country, do we have sufficient examples and illustrations about how we can make this real in different places or on different services?
That's a really good challenge, because of course we don't even really have the Greater Manchester example yet. You know, what we have is a lot of promises which won't be delivered for another couple of years by and large. And there is something slightly strange about the way that, I mean, Manchester's done a fantastic job of winning the argument, but it's often won the argument without knowing quite what it will do with the power when it gets it. And I'm particularly struck with the skills system. We've been looking at doing some work around colleges and skills, and no one in local government who is getting these powers seems to know what they'll actually do with them yet. Now, that's fine. I'm fine with that, but it's curious. Do we have enough examples? I think one of the problems that you'll hear if you go into the Treasury and talk about this integration agenda is that they can't quite understand, if this stuff is so obvious, why isn't it happening already? Why aren't people just getting on and doing it? Now, there are lots of reasons, like the fact that performance regimes don't align properly, budgets aren't pooled, all the rest of it. But fundamentally, I think probably too many councils, but also their partners, are waiting for something to happen. They're waiting for the Treasury to announce a programme. That doesn't mean that there aren't examples, but they're small and we're still building them up. So, you know, to take an example, I live in Greenwich. Greenwich has a fantastic example of integrated health and social care. They more or less have ended delayed discharge. They're getting people diverted from A&E. They haven't managed to quantify savings to the NHS. That's difficult because demand for A&E is going up all the time. Mm. So you can stop people going, but what you're really doing is just creating a bit of extra space. But they have made about 900,000 worth of savings for social care. So I think we are starting to see the evidence coming through. I think the real challenge for cities over the next couple of years is to start building up and evidencing this stuff a lot more quickly. Mm. Because at the moment we are still in this sort of slightly funny stage of trying to make the case without good numbers. Mm. And that will get us so far. but the hatchet-faced men and women who Tony's been talking about from the Treasury need data.
Yeah. Tony, turning to think about the sort of growth side of the equation, obviously one of the ways to reduce the deficit is to grow the size of the economy, and therefore, you know, deficit becomes a smaller share. You've done work through London Finance Commission and other avenues around, you know, the fiscal side of the debate and how that can stimulate growth. Does that get us towards some of the evidence and some of the examples, some of the numbers that Simon was alluding to? Where are we on that agenda?
Well, I mean, when the London Finance Commission was doing its work, it did take the trouble to commission some research to look at the academic evidence on whether fiscal devolution, devolving tax raising powers and so on, actually boosted economic growth. And I have to tell you, the evidence is mixed. It's not that there was any evidence that it led to lower growth, it's just there wasn't much evidence that it led to higher growth. And we were very upfront about that in the report. However, nevertheless, there are good reasons which include the rational behaviour when you're faced with an incentive for devolving a bit of tax-raising power to cities and other levels, other subnational levels of government. So, you know, there's a good democratic reason for doing it. There's frankly a good reason for doing it in Britain because it's too centralised. And thirdly, in terms of the Centre for Cities, world, there's a good economic incentive reason for doing it, whatever the evidence shows, because I just think that if you say to local areas, cities, city regions, whatever, if you behave in a particular way, that will generate more tax yield, they'll do that. They will notice that. Many of them will notice that. And they will, if they're absolutely sure that if they make a particular set of investments, then they will get a higher yield of tax, which they can then invest in something else. They're going to take that opportunity. Now, there are downsides to this in our system, which is that other people will hear, aha, winner takes all. Mm. And that is the downside, that there are people, even inside the local government family, who are not very enthusiastic about radical fiscal decentralisation or, you know, handing taxes over to local areas, because they fear that some places may get left behind. Mm. It isn't all the Treasury or central government's fault.
Can these issues be resolved? You know, how do we both get the incentives right so we encourage more growth, more activity around the economy, whilst not losing, I think, one of the central elements of the system that we've had, which is about redistribution, and it's about not just the winner takes all. Are they mutually incompatible, or can we find a way to deal with it?
Within the current finance system, it's pretty hard to have both. Before 2010, we had a system that was very based on need and trying to get need recognised very powerfully. Now we have a system that's increasingly based on growth, except the current growth incentive around keeping the business rate isn't really much of an incentive at all, because it doesn't deliver very much extra money. Yeah, I remember reading that Camden got a very, very small sum of money for the gigantic King's Cross development it's building. So it is hard to have both. I think you either have to kind of give people very sharp incentives for growth, if that's what you really want, or you have to focus on need, unless you're going to do something very big with the finance system and change it in some way we can't envisage now. I guess the argument that you'd make about why that might be okay is because, theoretically at least, if you devolve those incentives for growth, what you should get is people focusing on the kinds of investments that will lead to job creation, lead to sustainable wealth creation. That does mean some places will win and others will lose. But if we get the governance structures right, actually we can link them together inside the same governance package. So that sounds very abstract, but look at Greater Manchester. Yep. It's built on that basis. The whole model there is built on that basis. South Manchester will grow. Oldham and Wigan probably won't grow that much. But we can connect Wigan to South Manchester and get people there into good jobs in there.
Yep.
I think that's the way to do it. It's not. It's to let go of the kind of the fiction of 60s and 70s regional policies that we're going to have high-quality jobs everywhere, and to say, look, it's just a law of economic gravity. Some places grow at some point in history, others don't. The question is, how do we get people to access the benefits of that growth most effectively?
How did you address this issue in the than the Finance Commission work, Tony, about essentially giving more autonomy, more powers, more fiscal freedom to London, and the concern of others that actually that would mean that London would grow ever faster and would retain ever more of its own proceeds of growth, and the rest of the country would be worse off as a result of that.
I mean, first, though we were the London Finance Commission, which was set up by the Mayor of London, the report was absolutely explicit that this could also work for other city regions. So that was very clear, and we had indeed representatives from Birmingham and from Manchester on the commission. So that was the one thing. But to address the question more generally, so, you know, if London were given greater fiscal autonomy, or Manchester or Leeds City Region, I mean, the thing is, if they were given their own tax-raising powers to any degree, then you would have to take, for every tax pound they were given extra, you'd take a pound of grant away from them, so they'd be neither better nor worse off. And it's not as if this is some weird hypothetical. This is sort of broadly the mechanism that was used when the business rate retention was introduced, and it's exactly what will have to be done for Scotland and Wales when their incredibly radical fiscal devolution, which apparently is possible within the United Kingdom, when all of that happens, that's what will be done there. So all you have to do is to say, well, you know, if you get a billion of extra tax yield from whatever tax, then you lose a billion in grant. From then, you're on your own. I mean, that's its simplest. Now, you could say, oh, well, even so, that area will then grow faster than everywhere else, and they'll keep more of the yield, and there'll be a bit less money for national government than there otherwise would have been. I think our answer to that was, well, if it does provide an incentive and somewhere grows a bit faster, then the taxes that we're ever going to decentralise or devolve are barely 10 to 15% of the total. So the other 85% of the taxes, income tax, VAT and all the others, will still be available to national government. And if the area is more successful at boosting growth, then those other taxes will rise as well. So national government will have even more money than it would have done otherwise.
On the reverse side of that, Simon, we often hear, particularly in the UK, we say, well, if you give more places autonomy, more freedom to do things, the risk is you're going to have more places like Detroit, which effectively went bankrupt. Is that a credible kind of response from those that don't want to see any more devolution, or not really?
It's not a credible response at all. Detroit can go bankrupt because it raises its own money, it has its own treasury. English local authorities can't do that. They raise such a small proportion of their own money. I mean, you know, council tax makes up maybe 25% of an average, you know, London borough or metropolitan borough's income. You know, we could double that. They could be raising half of it. Half their budget is still underwritten by sources of central government finance. You add on to that the fact that a local authority in England has to set a balanced budget every year, and we see no sign of that going away. That means they can't borrow for current spending. They can't borrow for day-to-day spending. I find it very hard to see how an authority given a bit more control of its finances could go bankrupt. However, there is quite a big question about whether a local authority could go bankrupt because of the level of government cuts. And we don't know what happens when a council can't afford to pay for its services anymore. So no chance, I think, really, of bankruptcy from devolution. Every chance of bankruptcy from cuts.
Okay. Let's look forward, I think, into the next Parliament as we're nearly there. Do you think we'll have balanced the books in terms of the next Parliament? I mean, do you think that, I've heard you speak before, Tony, around, you know, the size of the central state, particularly as a share of GDP, being relatively constant, and there's some challenges if you want to reduce it below that, which some proposals seem to suggest, and that will require quite fundamentally different ways of doing things. But if we look through to the end of 2020, where will we be on this agenda?
I don't think it's going to get much easier. I mean, one of the interesting things about the general election campaign is that it reinforces again and again and again that the major parties don't want to tax almost anybody much, or more than they are today. And that's, you know, that's a respectable view. But trying to, you know, imagine if only we could tax the super rich a lot, we could have a bigger state, is, I'm afraid, just mathematically doesn't add up. I mean, you could have a much bigger state than we have now. You could have one, such a thing, but you'd have to tax people on, frankly, average or just above average earnings quite a lot, one way or another. And we don't seem to want to do that. In fact, no government has got taxation as a share of GDP above 37-38% of GDP since 1990. So if we're going to have anything like a balanced budget, depending on how you define it, then the state public spending can't be much above 38-39% of GDP, lower than the long-term average. And of course, the other thing the general election has done inevitably is reinforce everybody trying to promise the health service more, you know, ensure the pensioners get their triple lock, and all of these things are all stuck there in you know, political aspic. Consequently, the pressure will continue on the unprotected budgets all the way through to 2020. And, you know, all of this assumes there's never another recession. So I don't think the next 5 years, whatever the result of the election, is going to be radically different for city government, local government, than the previous years. And that means that they're going to rely ever more on private sector activity and just driving the private sector part of their economy, because that can grow.
Simon, your kind of reflections or thoughts on the next 5 years, or maybe even slightly longer than that, where will we be?
Well, I think Tony's right that austerity for local government is pretty much locked in. You know, most councils that I speak to are expecting it to continue at roughly the pace it has for the last 5 years. And they think that will last until 2020 and possibly beyond. I think the vast majority of councils can probably sort of stagger on until 2020. There are some that can't, particularly smaller ones. But most councils, by and large, could probably just about make it to the end of the decade. Whether they can go much beyond that, I don't know. And what the cost of that staggering on is, I don't know. Because don't forget, you know, we talk about councils, we talk about growth, street scene, the built environment. Actually, the bulk of what they spend their money on is child protection, adult social care. And, you know, child protection is already in a state of low-level crisis across the country. Elderly care probably isn't far behind. So I suspect we're in for sort of 5 rather cheap and nasty years of sort of low-level crisis and people sort of muddling through as best they can. What I hope that will do is convince the national politicians that the only way out of this is to allow a much more radical sort of transformation of the way local governance works. And there are lots of forms that transformation could take. You know, a lot of people are talking about reorganising local government at the moment. I'm not sure if I'm a big fan of that, but that's one way of transforming it. I just don't think it would save that much money in the long run, but it would save some. You look at, you know, something like social care, we could put that into the NHS. We could transfer some big new services into local government. What about things like GP commissioning? We're already adopting a sort of halfway house on that in some areas. So you put some big new functions in and you allow local government to take on a much more active role in integrating, not just with social care, but with benefits, with colleges, with the work programme. And you might just find that the pressure of budget cuts plus reform actually does generate a new model of doing city government. And I think for me, that's, you know, perhaps I'm being a bit too optimistic here, but the thing that I think I'm working towards and that we're working towards at NLGN is trying to anticipate what that world would look like and how you can get on with building it from the ground up without having to wait for the centre to do it for you. Because I think if we wait for central politicians, we'll be waiting for a very long time.
And on that note, you've been listening to City Talks. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by the Centre for Cities. We're an independent, non-partisan think tank dedicated to understanding and improving city economies. For more on our research and events programme, including our extensive back catalogue, please visit our website, centreforcities.org.